you know, so...
Thank you.
that, but at this point, I had no idea of any kind of otherworldly phenomena. And my husband actually called me to our bedroom window. One wall of our bedroom is a window. So, and we're pretty high on the mountain. So we have a panoramic view, and there is a picture there so people can see the topography. But we know what car lights and street lights and helicopter lights and flares look like. Occasionally we see flares deployed. So we were very well educated on what's out there. And when something unusual pops up, it gets our attention. Well, on February 6, 1995, the night before my birthday, I mean, there were many serendipitous things that happened that I'll share with you if you like. But I was taking a bath like I usually do, and in the evening, and my husband, who is really the skeptic, you know, got kind of excited. He says, "What the heck is this?" Now, this is a little below us, okay? Over a private, now we're a private gated community, nestled in the mountains. So there is no way, and I underline, that this could have possibly been military. Okay, this is a no-fly zone, it's a gated private community nestled in the mountains, and dangerous actually for anybody to fly over, but this is a little below us, because we're pretty high on the mountain. Hovering above the treacherous desert landscape, as he calls me out of the bath, I run over to the window, dripping, and there are three amber orbs in a pyramid formation, one on top and two close underneath. And my first thought was, you know, producing video and workbook curriculums was to get my video camera, but it was downstairs. And I didn't know how long this was going to last. And anyone that sees something miraculous like this doesn't move. I mean, people will say, well, why didn't more people get pictures on March 13th? Well, you are so in awe, and you hear that over and over again from the witnesses, that you are frozen in time. You are just so mixed with what you're seeing, which I was, but I tried to take everything in mentally, the size, the shape, the color, and so forth, and the distance. And I have to say that it was one of the most amazing, amazing moments of my life. I mean, here were orbs, and I call them orbs because the light did not extend outside the edge. The light was self-contained. And they were about 3 to 6 feet each, oval-shaped, like an egg on its side. But there were three distinct objects, again, one on top and two closely aligned underneath, like a pyramid. And the color within each orb was a uniform amber color throughout. And it didn't glare at all. That was, I mean, that got my attention immediately. Every other light out there, street lights, house lights, car lights, whatever, glared. These did not glare. They were very soothing, very mesmerizing. And a thought popped into my head, if I don't get a picture of this, nobody's going to believe it. And, of course, I had looked underneath to see if anybody was there, which is a very treacherous desert landscape there, and it was totally dark. And I ran to my closet to grab a 35-millimeter camera that I have to capture sunsets. I collect sunset, actually, on the photo page. If anybody's there, at the very bottom of the photo page, you'll see two different sunsets, two different months, November and December of 2000, where there's a giant rod-shaped object in the same place. I did not see it when I was taking the pictures, but it's there. So these things are around, but we can get to that too. But at any rate, I grabbed my 35-millimeter camera, and my husband calls me back. He says, "Get over here quick. One of them is disappearing." And as I run over to the big window, we both watched, again, totally in awe. The top orb did not budge. Now, the only movies that I saw up to that time was E.T. and Close Encounters. And with two young boys growing up, we watched the original Star Trek series.
Oh, yeah.
Because of the wonderful messages. But I have to tell you, the I don't know if you remember the Romulan cloaking device that, like, kind of wavered.
Oh, yeah, we're showing our kids these episodes now.
Oh, okay, cool.
We're going back over the classic ones.
Oh, that's great. No, they are phenomenal. And
they
at
are.
The time, it was like, you know, so, but at any rate, that was the only thing that popped into my head, was that it was cloaking, but it didn't waver like the Romulan cloaking device.
Yeah.
It didn't budge. It just started to dim. But as it was dimming, it was more of a mechanical thing. It started to implode from the outside inwards and get smaller and smaller and smaller and smaller and smaller until it was a dot. And I have to admit, and I didn't admit this till right after the mass sighting, that even though it disappeared, it still felt like it was there, okay? Now, where did it go? Was it, you know, it just felt like it was still there. Did it go to another dimension? That's the only thing that I can liken it to in our realm of science at this point. But at any rate, I stepped quickly out onto the balcony, caught a picture of the two lower orbs. And that's the picture that you'll see on the website. And while I'm looking, now, first of all, I noticed an eerie silence as if time had stopped. It was just bizarre. And as I'm intently watching these two orbs, I have to admit, Karen, and again, I didn't admit this to anybody until after the last meeting, that it felt like something was looking back at me. Going through my mind, I was thinking, who are you? What are you? Do you know that I'm here? I'd love to meet you. And that's exactly what I thought.
Really?
And the next
totally.
Thing, yeah, exactly. Exactly. It just felt like something was watching. You know, like that's what it felt like. And the next thing I remember, the left bottom orb started to disappear, and I quickly shot a picture of that, and that's the next picture you'll see, which is really miraculous, Karen, because I happened to catch one of the orbs half disappeared, and you can see it right there, and one's still there. Now,
okay,
what's really...
I'm at the photo page, and I'm looking at the, which picture is the one that shows
okay,
one disappeared.
If you go to the first picture shows the topography, and you can actually see South Mountain and the Estrella Mountain Range intersect. Do you see that?
Yeah, I'm going back to the first picture. It's been scrolling through on a slideshow while we're talking.
Well, underneath the slideshow are the individual pictures. That might be easier.
Okay. Yep, got the first one.
Okay.
A daylight
now,
photo, so you can see the mountains and...
Well, just to go back to that picture for a second, which is really interesting, talk about serendipity. And I don't want to jump around, but very interesting is that 6 months before the mass sighting, I was asked to present my substance abuse prevention education program. And I have an AIDS and a teen pregnancy and a substance abuse program out in schools. Discovery Education is distributing as we speak. But they had asked me to present the substance abuse program at the one school that they had at the Gila River Indian Reservation, which is in the basin in between South Mountain, which is right behind the airport, and then miles behind it is the Estrella Mountain Range, and there's an area where they intersect. Now, what was interesting is that if you look at my pictures, even the pictures from 95, 2 years before the mass sighting, interesting, and we didn't know this until a year after the mass sighting. It was like over 3 years later when I had them analyzed by Dr. Bruce McAbee, a Navy optical physicist in Washington, D.C., that he noticed that there were the same phenomena disappearing in the background in the same location, where South Mountain and the Estrellas intersect, that area, as I would also capture 2 months before the mass sighting and during the mass sighting, okay? And 2 months before the mass sighting, interestingly enough, not only, well, I'll get to that in a second. Okay, we'll go through it. It won't get too confusing. So after the mass sighting, I went back to the native peoples in that area. And because my pictures keep indicating that these phenomena keep showing up in that region, in that area, in that location, and I asked them, did you happen to see strange lights on March 13th? And they started to laugh. And I said, is that funny? And they said, are you kidding? We look up at them for centuries. We call them sky people, light beings. I had no idea. I mean, that was the first I had heard of that they, not only those native cultures, but cultures around the world actually have, and even here in Arizona, the Hopi, have protocols to invite these phenomena in. many of them feel that these orbs are ancestors and spirit world coming to bring them guidance and inspiration and comfort. And when you look into that whole end of it, which we can get into a little bit later, it is so fascinating. I mean, these things have been around since human documentation began, but I didn't miss point. At any rate, if you look at that second picture that's there with the two orbs, the close-up orbs, do you have them?
Yep.
You can see in the background there are four orbs in a line. Do you see that? There should be an arrow.
Oh.
Okay. And then as the closed orbs are disappearing, and that last picture that I took with one half disappeared and one still there, there are two orbs in the background. So we postulate that when there was three orbs in the pyramid formation, the line of six that I would also capture 2 years later, 2 months before the mass sighting, is in the same location. Now let me tell you about that one.
Okay.
After this sighting, I didn't even know who to show the picture to. And only the last picture turned. Pardon me?
I can imagine.
Yeah, only the
picture. And what do you do with it?
Right. Well, only the last picture turned out at the time, and I was told by a very professional photography developing company that all the other strips were blank. These are 35 millimeter. And I have to tell you, to this day, I could kick myself that I did throw some out because they were blank, and what did I need them for, right? So God knows what was in those. But 2 years later, and I have to tell you that not having any interest or knowledge in this, I knew no one who was into the topic at all. I shared it with just a couple of family members, okay, because it was just so absurd and out there, but wondered for 2 years what this advanced intelligent technology was doing outside our bedroom window. We both saw it. I got pictures of it. What the heck? I didn't know that we had this kind of advanced technology on Earth. And what was it doing there? Why did I happen to take pictures of it? Why was my husband with me? I wondered about those things, and I never thought I would ever get an answer, but at any rate, I eventually put the picture away and, you know, periodically, and when we're in the bedroom, by the way, and the window, you know, we look out the window, you know, and something's unusual, whether it's a dust storm, like we had the dust storms recently here in Phoenix, as well as a fire out there, anything unusual catches our eye. But I didn't see anything, nothing remotely similar to that close until 2 months before the mass sighting. And this is really important data, Karen. I have to just interject, and many people have no clue that this data even exists, but it does. And I have to say in good conscience again that eventually I just couldn't stick it in a drawer because it's important data that speaks for itself and cannot be denied. But 2 months before the mass sighting, I noticed three amber orbs, huge amber orbs, this time in a row, far northwest. And I'm lying in bed, and I'm looking at them, and I'm thinking to myself, now, wait a minute. They're in a formation, equidistant from each other, three in a row. They're amber and hovering for many minutes. And I watched each one implode again from the outside inwards from right to left, and they were gone. And I thought, wow, that was strangely similar to 95, but they were at a distance. The next evening, my husband at the time was on several medical and hospital boards, and he was at a meeting, and about 8 o'clock, I noticed that the same three orbs in a line, in an equidistant line, are now in front of South Mountain. Now, I knew that they were in front of South Mountain because there's red blinking lights to warn planes coming into Sky Harbor, which is just north in front of South Mountain, to warn the planes that there's a mountain there. And these were definitely lower. And I thought to myself, okay, that's enough. I've got to get my video camera. So I ran downstairs, grabbed my camera, which was fully charged, by the way, go out to the front area. I got about 18 seconds worth. The battery goes dead. Okay, so I run in and I hook up the battery. I go out, they're gone. About a half hour later, my husband was coming up the drive, and I met him outside, and I said, honey, remember I told you about the 3 amber orbs far west last night? Well, about a half an hour ago, they were right in front of South Mountain, and as I'm pointing to that area, they reappear in the same spot. Okay? And I thought, oh my goodness, I've got to get a picture of this. So luckily enough, and I have come not to believe in coincidence, and I do believe that everything's for a reason, and I have to say that 35 millimeter is the best way to analyze these phenomena. So I ran upstairs, I grabbed my 35 millimeter, and certainly not video. They look very different in video. Video, they're much smaller, they're white, they flicker. Even though the formations are compelling, 35 millimeter is the best form at this point for the layperson to capture. So I ran out on the
back. I'm sorry. It even has 35 millimeter film anymore.
right. But at the time, that's what we had. We didn't have digital cameras.
If anyone does, it is absolutely the best thing for analyzing it because
it is.
You know,
it
people
is
can look at the negatives.
Absolutely. And if it's there in the negative, it's there in the negative. And
yeah.
Also, you know, digital, when you try to enlarge it, it breaks apart. So, at any rate, I get out on the balcony. I'm just ready to shoot the 3. Suddenly, 6 lights pop on top. A massive span. Karen, I want to tell you, I started to shake. And you can see in that first picture, it's wavy because I'm shaking. It was unnerving.
Hmm.
Not having had an explanation for 95. Suddenly, here is this advanced technology or whatever popping up a massive span of equidistant, 6 equidistant lights over a mile wide over the 3. And I'm thinking to myself, is this a mothership or a fleet? I mean, it was really unnerving because it was so massive and huge. And I started clicking away. And I happened to get 6 pictures in a row. And several are posted there on the photo page on the phoenixlights.net of this phenomena head on turning into a V-shape. Now, the second picture, which has 1 bright light in the center with 2 on each side, and you can see 2 underneath it, is really, really poignant. Because remember, this is taken 2 months before the mass sighting, January 23rd, 1997. But it's exactly what most people would describe traversing the whole state on March 13th. 5 lights in a V formation, and many of them were talking about 5 lights with 2 trailing. And that's what I caught 2 months before the mass sighting. Mm-hmm. Not only that, it was so unnerving that I did not sleep well that night. And I woke up the next morning and I figured, you know what, there has to be a logical explanation for this, and somebody else must have seen this. Now, I had run in while the 3 lights were disappearing from underneath the big V formation and called the Arizona Republic. And a gal answered, and I said, you got to get somebody out there quick. There's strange lights in front of South Mountain. Get somebody to take a picture. Tell me what they are. Well, when I finished my sentence, they were gone. So the next morning, the first call I made was to the Arizona Republic. And I asked if anybody had called the night before to report strange lights in front of South Mountain. And the operator gets off. She gets right back on. She says, nope, nobody called. Well, I know I called. Okay? So I said, well, you know, my husband and I did see something strange. And, you know, I'm just trying to find out what it is. Can you give me some direction here? And she says, I have no idea. She says, maybe Luke Air Force Base was sending off something experimental and they didn't tell the public about it. And I figured, you know what, Karen, that sounds reasonable, but let me check it out, okay? So I call Luke Air Force Base. And I have to say, from the get-go, the operator had an attitude. And I was trying to be very professional. I said, my husband and I are both physicians. We live mountainside in Paradise Valley. And we saw some strange lights in front of South Mountain last night. Do you have any idea what they might have been? And the first thing she said is, I can tell you right now, they didn't come into Luke Air Force Base, and they didn't come out from here, so we had nothing to do with it.
Well, it's pretty competitive.
Well, be that as it may, we did see something, and I want to sleep tonight. So could you try to, you know, help me out here? Do you have the number of a UFO organization? Well, then she got really annoyed. And she says, well, you said you saw them in front of South Mountain, so maybe they saw something at the airport, which is in front of South Mountain. So okay. Now it was a mission. Karen, it was a mission. I had to find out what these things were. So I call the FAA at the airport. And again, this is the following morning, the first thing in the morning. And I get the operator on the phone, and she was really nice. And I described the same thing to her, and she says, you know what, there's some air traffic controllers here this morning that were here last night. Let me see if anybody saw anything. I said, great. Well, she left me hanging. It seemed like an eternity. She left me hanging for over 5 minutes. Finally, she gets on the phone, and she says, well, actually, there is air traffic controllers that are here this morning that were here last night. I said, oh, could I please talk to somebody? Because I just want to confirm that we saw the same thing. And again, she kept me hanging. And finally, one of the fellows, who, by the way, is very soft-spoken, very low-key, and a meteorologist, gets on the phone. He was more excited than I was. He said, did you see those three lights that popped up at 8 o'clock last night? I said, yes, that's why I called. He said there were three at 8 o'clock, and then there were six that popped up at 8:30. I said, yes, that's what I saw. He said, oh, I'm so excited that you saw them, too. You're at a distance, and we talked. And he says we looked on radar because they were, now this is really important data as well. Mm-hmm. They were at 1,000 feet altitude in Class B restricted airspace. Okay, this phenomena appeared in restricted air, and we're talking about a 30-mile radius around the center of the airport. Anyone that comes into that area, particularly at 1,000 feet altitude, must call into the tower, and nobody did. So they looked on radar, did not show up on radar, and they were really concerned, and they took up their binoculars to look, and what he described were six points of light, perfectly equidistant from each other, massive spans over a mile wide that seemed to be attached to something, but they couldn't see what it was attached to. And we would hear that again over and over again, you know, during the mass sighting. But what was really interesting is they watched as this formation turned into a V and against the wind. Now, he was a meteorologist, so we knew what he was talking about. Now, that's exactly what I captured on 35-millimeter pictures. And he says, then, after it turned, as a unit, the whole thing moved very slowly behind South Mountain. So I said, so what was it? And there was silence. And then he finally said, beats me. I said, wait a minute, you're an air traffic controller. You're supposed to know what's in the airspace and you don't know what it was. He was just as intrigued and said, you know, let's keep in contact, which we did. And then I brought up my video camera and connected it to electricity. And every night after that, I was seeing these orbs in different formations, usually three at a time, and documenting them on film. I don't know why, but I felt compelled to document them on film. And, of course, if you read my book, you can see that my husband wasn't quite as enamored with this. I mean, he kept making jokes, and he said it was silly. And, you know, everybody reacts different. Everybody comes from a different background, a different belief system. Some people can't deal with this, and some people don't want to deal with it. But the data is there if you want to look at it. And at any rate, I really felt compelled to document what I did on film up into and including, which to me was just another night, March 13th, 1997. Now, let me take a little step backwards. About a week before the mass sighting, it was getting a little ridiculous. I mean, I'd be, you know, in bed talking to my husband or whatever, and I'd see one of these lights pop up, and I'd say, hold that thought, and I would run out and have to photograph these things. So it was getting a little ridiculous because we didn't have any clue what they might have been and or who was creating them. So I started showing the video to some of my friends. Now, again, the video doesn't do it justice. In the video, the orbs are much smaller, they flicker, they're white instead of amber. But the formations were so compelling that, you know, they were really curious too. And this is how close I was, Karen. A friend of a friend had a neighbor who had a friend who knew the past president of MUFON, Mutual UFO.
Oh, wow.
Yes, that's how close I was, okay. So I contacted him, and he hadn't heard about anything yet, but I have to tell you that there were other people, including Steve Blonder, who happened to call MUFON to his roof the night of the mass sighting. And he, like myself, was documenting what looked like spinning balls of energy. And if you look through my website, you'll see that. And was just mesmerized by these things and called MUFON to check it out. And he happened to be with a group standing on his balcony when shortly before 10 o'clock on March 13th, now I'm going to go back, at 8:20, I saw on March 13th, at 1997, I saw one light appear, one orb, just as I had been seeing for previous nights, far northwest. Now, at that time, the first official call, even though people were starting to see things at 5:30 that day, 5:30 p.m., the first official call came in from a retired police officer in Paulden, Arizona, that he had just seen the formation, V formation of light, V phenomena, V object, whatever. Also at 8:20, which is really fascinating in and of itself, there was a call the next morning at 3 a.m. to the National UFO Reporting Center, Peter Davenport, who recorded the whole conversation, a very, very detailed report from an alleged crewman from Luke Air Force Base, who shared very detailed numbers and serial numbers and names and so forth, and the fact that there was an object that appeared over 7th Avenue and Indian School, which is right in the center of Phoenix. Military jets with afterburners were sent off to investigate and get gun camera film. And as they got close, not only did things go haywire in their craft, but what I was told was that the craft disappeared and that this crewman was actually one of the people that helped one of the pilots out of his aircraft because he was so shaken up by it, okay? And we have confirmation, by the way, from civilian witnesses who saw the military jets take off and try to intercept with afterburners on, okay? So that was all happening about 8:20. A little after 9 o'clock, I see one lone far south. Now, that was unusual because usually when I would see them, they would be in the same general area, but this time it was on the way on the other side of the sky, and this was when, by the way, witnesses were seeing these phenomena down in Tucson, which is about 2 hours south of us. Right before 10 o'clock, a little before 10 o'clock, while my husband and I were just getting ready to watch the news, all of a sudden, the same formation popped up in the same location as 2 months before. And remember, I had only gotten it, you know, I had gotten 35 meter pictures of it, but I was told they didn't turn out at the time, and thank goodness I kept those strips because there were some other important pictures on the end of those strips. But in the meantime, and I'll get to that in a minute, but in the meantime, I grabbed my video camera, get outside. By the time I got there, the thing must have turned because I got the three endpoints of a giant V, what people would also describe statewide. Now, what's interesting is that when you look at Steve Blonder's video, which is amazing, it's an arrowhead of five lights, and when you watch them disappear or turn or whatever they're doing, the last three lights of his V coordinate exactly in characteristics and timing with the three lights that go off again from right to left in my video. Okay? Now tuck that away. Anyway, on Tuesday, we were supposed to meet, I was supposed to meet with a field investigator from MUFON that the fellow had referred me to the week before, and he had called to postpone because the then state director, Tom Taylor's mom, had passed that Saturday and the funeral was Wednesday, and the only window of opportunity I had for the next couple weeks was Friday morning at 10 o'clock, and he said, fine. Well, the next was a mass sighting. I walk in with video in hand, talk about serendipity, to this MUFON field investigator's house. Now, I had no idea what was going on statewide. What I just shared with you is what I experienced. The first question he says to me, he says, did you see the mass sighting last night? And I said, excuse me? He said, oh, yeah, hundreds if not thousands of people saw a mile-wide formation of lights or craft, and NBC was coming to interview him in a half an hour, okay? Now, first of all, it was the first I heard of it that this went on. Secondly, I had done health reporting for not only NBC in Philadelphia in the 70s, but in the early 80s in Phoenix. They might know who I am, and I didn't know what we were dealing with. Was it military? Was it a hoax or whatever? But it's not about me. It never has been about me. It's about the data. And I said to him, you know what? I'm out of here. I said, yeah, I mean, I didn't know what we were dealing with, and I really didn't want to get involved as far as that goes. But I did want people to see what we saw, and I was very happy to share my video. I mean, hey, that's what I've been documenting for 2 years, you know. So I gave him a copy, and I said, share it with whoever you like. Well, for the rest, and I said, by the way, if anybody wants to talk to me over the phone, I'm happy to. And for the rest of the day, the phone was ringing off the hook. By 4:30 that afternoon, and this is the first time, by the way, and I will make this clear, because we watched the news the night before to see if anybody saw anything, and there was nothing mentioned on the 10 o'clock news. This was 4 o'clock in the afternoon. The first news came on, 4:30. And my video was plastered on any news station. It was really fun. I mean, I have to say it was exciting because finally, not only did I learn that thousands of people saw what I had been seeing, but also we were able to show something from the night before. By the 9 o'clock news, a couple of other videos came forward, and one was Steve Blonders of the Arrowhead, and it makes for itself. All you have to do is look at his video. Those lights are attached to something or have a field keeping them in rock-solid formation. And then what also came out was a boomerang. There's actually two boomerang videos. And they were, and this is important to note, taken after 10 o'clock. They were taken about 10 after, a quarter after 10 o'clock. And one of the boomerangs, by the way, I have never used in any of my programs because it looks a little haphazard, and we'll get to what happened with the boomerang videos in a minute. But at any rate, now I'm learning thousands of people saw what we saw. There's other videos from that night. It was really exciting, I have to tell you. But, of course, I was curious what the heck was going on. And yeah. I just wanted to stay in the background and see how this unfolded. Well, about a week later, I see my video on the news again. And they're interviewing a fella who is right here in Tempe, which is just minutes from my home, really, and near ASU, who happened to be, he's also a computer specialist and had this Village Labs, it was called, but he also on the side for like 20, 30 years was analyzing photographs of UFOs worldwide. He was an authority. And he was showing from his vast database these orbs in triangle formation from all over the world. Now, that was the first I heard of that. I mean, you know, it was one thing to hear about the native cultures believing that there are other intelligences out there and they invite them in and they've been seeing them for centuries. But here I'm hearing a week after the mass sighting that this is happening worldwide. And he's showing pictures from Belgium and UK and, you know, talking about Mexico and other countries that have had similar sightings that just blew me away. I mean, that really got to me, because then I thought, my goodness, this is happening worldwide and we don't know what this is. So yeah. That really set me on a journey, Karen.
Yes, that's one of the most amazing things about this particular case, I think, is like the extent of it, the number of witnesses and the number mm-hmm. of people who photographed it and videotaped it and talked about it. And I mean, I've talked to skeptics, and I'm sure you've had the same experience. People will say to me, well, yeah, if UFOs are real, how come the only people who ever see them is like one guy who's out in the woods hunting and drinking beer and he's by himself? How come, mm-hmm. you know, groups never see them? And I'm like, how come you don't look at the evidence?
Exactly. Exactly.
And people say they never appear over cities. I'm like, they've appeared over Manhattan and Chicago and Phoenix and Los Angeles and Mexico City. I mean, where have you been?
Absolutely.
You know, these
Absolutely.
People don't... Yeah.
Well, they don't look. I mean, and that is a choice, but it is there. And what happened, actually, Karen, is that I didn't know any of that. I didn't know anything about the Lubbock Lights from the 50s or the Hudson Valley sighting or any of that. I knew nothing. So after I saw that this was happening worldwide, it really sent me on a journey to try to find a logical source and meaning for what I had witnessed and photographed. And I went to extremely to have it explained to me. I went down, like you were talking about physicians before and how they need the evidence. Well, I needed somebody uh-huh. to tell me what the heck. And I went down to the University of Arizona Optical Science Department. The head of the Optical Science Department, by the way, Dr. Richard Powell, worked on the Star Wars project. And he actually became vice president of research at University of Arizona. Has been a dear, dear friend and supporter, and he got a whole group of people together to try to analyze my pictures, and I talk about that in the book as well. It's a fascinating story. But the Consciousness Studies Department, Dr. Gary Schwartz, as well as ASU, Arizona State University, Geology, Anthropology, Astronomy, and Mathematics Departments, and the renowned Brooks Institute of Photography in California, in Santa Barbara, and no one could tell me what my things were. They could tell me what they weren't, but nobody could tell me what my represented. We don't have the technology yet to definitively define what these things are, but that doesn't mean they're not real. I mean, it took 17 centuries, Karen, 17 centuries, think about that, and that's in modern times, before humans realized with the advent of the microscope that there are zillions of microorganisms all around us. Mm-hmm. And just in the past few decades, we've discovered that there are electromagnetic energies around every living cell. Well, just because we can't see these energies, or radio waves, or gamma rays, or these tiny living entities, it doesn't mean they're not real. You may just be looking on the AM dial for an FM frequency at this point. So,
That's beautifully put. On that note, I have to jump in and interrupt because we have completed our whole first hour and we need to take a quick break. But it's just been so fascinating hearing your personal account of all of these things that I can't get over how quickly the first hour just flew by. And I've got a couple of questions on the message board from listeners, so when we come back for the second hour, I'd like to bring up these questions, and I also have a few more things that I wanted to ask you, and it sounds like you have some more to tell us as well. So don't go away, listeners. We're just going to take a very quick break, and you're listening to Through the Keyhole on the Paranormal Radio Network and also on UPRN 105.7 FM in New Orleans. Once again, I'm your host, Karen Dolan, and my guest this evening is Dr. Lynn Kitai, author of The Phoenix Lights, and her personal experience with the Phoenix Light sightings from 1997, and also her own experience from 1995. So don't go too far. We will be right back.
Thank you. Everybody take a trip with me. Well, down the Mississippi, down in New Orleans. They got a honeysuckle growing on a honeysuckle vine. And love is a blooming there all the time. Wherever Southern Belle is a Mississippi queen.
Down the Mississippi, down in New Orleans.
Hi, everyone. We're back, and you are listening to Through the Keyhole on the Paranormal Radio Network and also on UPRN 105.7 FM in New Orleans. I'm your host, Karen Dolan, and my guest this evening is Dr. Lynn Kitai, who is one of the main witnesses and also the author of a book about the Phoenix Lights, a UFO sighting that took place in Arizona in 1997. If you're just joining us now, well, you missed some really great stuff in the first hour, I have to say. Lynn was describing her experiences in the 1997 sighting and also her some personal sighting prior to that in 1995. But you're in luck. We still have a lot to discuss in the second hour. So strap in and listen. Enjoy the ride because there's still a lot to cover here. Lynn, when we went to break, we were... Gosh, I'm trying to remember exactly where we left off.
Well, one of the things I wanted to share that we kind of glazed over earlier, which is very interesting, and because, I knew nothing about this topic, and not only when I found out that the Native cultures here in Arizona and worldwide have been seeing these things and inviting these things in, they have protocols for centuries. I pushed my entire professional life aside once I found out that thousands of people had seen what I had been seeing and documenting on film. The Native cultures here, right, the Gila River Indian Reservation, I had mentioned that they, shared this with me. And also the fact, which is really important, is there are petroglyphs not only near their homes and in the mountains. They call the Estrellas. Estrella, they said to me, means star in Spanish. And to them, they call the Estrella Mountains the gateway to the stars. They believe that there's a gateway in that area. And if you go on my website, on the Phoenix Lights Network website, and look on the photo page, thephoenixlights.net, you will see that consistently, and in science we look for repeatability, and you'll see consistently that these phenomena keep showing up right where the South Mountain and the Estrellas intersect, and that's where their very sacred ground is. So is that a real possibility? I think that's an interesting aside. But in the meantime, after the mass sighting, not only did I go to extreme lengths to have my dad explain to me without any answers, but I also started, and we're talking meticulous. I mean, I pushed my entire professional, successful medical career aside, and every single day I would sit at the computer, and the computer was really just getting started then, so I had to do a lot of ancillary reading and calling and talking to militaries and talking to experts in the field and keeping a meticulous journal of everything, of the media reports that were out there, whether they were TV or in the paper, witness reports, the military, the conversations that I had, and also the studies that I was finding. I was finding that these phenomena have happened since human documentation began, that there are primitive caves in Peru and Pakistan that have long extinct animals etched out on the walls of these caves, but in the sky there's what we would call today a UFO. How did they know that? How could they even imagine that unless they had seen it? In the Bible, which I had no idea, I was introduced to that by Michael Tanner, one of the investigators at Village Labs. There are so many references to these orbs and to wheels of light and fire in the Bible, as well as the 15th and 16th centuries. We have frescoes and paintings where people are on the ground looking up at the sky, and you can see that there's a UFO with a being in the UFO. Where did they even conceive of that? And even Foo Fighters, and I'm jumping fast ahead, but in World War II, there were orbs in rigid formation. I talked to Dr. Richard Haynes, who is a PhD psychologist and has done studies of thousands of pilots, and also he studied the Foo Fighters in World War II. And he told me that they were identical to what my husband and I saw up close and personal 2 years before the mass sighting. These orbs in rock solid formations of two or three would fly around the aircraft of each side. And it wasn't until after the war, because each side thought somebody had this advanced spy technology, that everyone found out, Germans and Japan and U.S., that nobody has this technology. Okay, so they've been around a long time, and certainly in the past decades with Lubbock Lights, Hudson Valley, and Belgium, and UK, and all over the world. I mean, there are so many similar cases worldwide. They've been around a long time, but I think the Phoenix Lights is one of the most documented, and certainly at this point, and I have to say, as the story unfolded, okay, as I'm keeping a journal, and again, there was no investigation, no explanation at all. And the USA Today article came out on June 18th, 97, opened up immediately our sighting to international scrutiny by the next morning. I mean, every news station, every morning show, it was just the buzz worldwide. And by the way, the Phoenix Lights was the first sighting ever that was talked about in chat rooms. Okay? So it really, yes. I mean, the Internet was just getting started then. Literally and figuratively. So at any rate, what was really interesting is that the next day, as I mentioned earlier, former Governor Fife Symington calls his press conference, says he knows who was the culprit, and he marches out this aide with a giant alien head and offends many, many people. Now, at that point, I was also looking for a logical explanation, but this is like flibberish, okay? So I continued calling the military bases. Nobody knew what they were. They were just as curious, and I do have some of the conversations in my book, which are quite comical in and of themselves. And the announcement that the military made, by the way, is that all planes were grounded by 7 o'clock. That was their official statement, okay? Until I get a call on July 24th, 1997, from the head of the PR at the Air National Guard. And she says, oh, Dr. Lynn, I think we know what those lights were back in March. And again, I was open to any logical explanation, so I was excited. I said, you do? She said, yes, do you believe in almost 5 months nobody ever thought to look at the log for visiting Air National Guard, and the Maryland Air National Guard was in town deploying flares in Operation Snowbird, which I have since been told means diversionary tactical maneuver, so I have no doubt the flares might have been deployed, okay, to get the attention off of the true unknowns. But she said, that must be what some people saw. Now, I had not told them what I had in my possession. And I said to her, now, when was the Maryland Air National Guard in town? She said, March 1st to the 15th. I said, so were they in town in January? She said, oh, no. I said, are you sure? She says, absolutely not. I said, well, I have 35-millimeter evidence of the same exact phenomena in the same exact location 2 months before the mass sighting, confirmed the next morning by air traffic controllers as hovering in Class B restricted airspace. And she says, you never told me that. And then I said, and yes, and besides, I said, by then I had educated myself to what flares look like. And I said, because again, I was looking for any logical explanation, and I said, and you're trying to tell me that flares that cannot keep a formation, that drift and drop, illumination flares, and that's what they said they deployed, illumination flares that have a parachute that they float slowly down to the ground within 5 minutes, okay, and they are used to illuminate the area around it, and it also illuminates a huge smoke trail from the flare itself, which, by the way, not one witness described any of that, okay? They cannot keep a formation. I said, and you're trying to tell me that flares that just float down haphazardly with the wind kept a rock-solid V formation a mile wide for hours and traversed the entire state, and there was silence, and she says, I have a call coming in. I'll get back to you. Well, I'm still waiting, and it's almost 15 years later, okay? Still waiting. Anyway, at that point, that really set up a red flag for me, personally. But, you know, I said, okay, look, and I wasn't the only one. If it flares, great, reenact it. Now, look, I had pictures that now we know the same exact phenomena are in the background in 95, 2 months before the mass sighting, and during the mass sighting. So, and I've had them subsequently as well, but at least those three sightings at the time, and I thought to myself, fine, you know, somebody did it three times, do it again. And actually, Frances Barwood, and I'll bring her into this now, Councilwoman Vice Mayor Frances Barwood did not see the Phoenix sights. But she had hundreds and hundreds, over 700 constituents call her and leave messages that wanted to know why there wasn't an investigation. And innocently, in May, during a council, she mentions that, you know, many of her constituents had asked her what's going on and maybe we should look into it. She was plastered. I have to tell you, Karen, at the time, there was so much ridicule and so much criticism and discrediting of people that came forward. I was so happy that I had just stayed anonymous, just doing my homework, and I continued doing my homework. And actually, she was not only such an amazing proponent and helped so many of us, including myself, just know that somebody was out there on our side. But 3 years later, she ran for Secretary of State on a platform to get answers for the Phoenix lights, and she, too, was pushing for a reenactment, okay? Finally, on March 7th, 2000, right before the third anniversary, we get the announcement. I'm talking big time, on TV, on the news, on the radio, in the paper, that three Air National Guards, I believe it was New York, Michigan, and California, and they must have been practicing for weeks, were coming to Phoenix to show everybody the Phoenix lights and do a flare deployment so we know that, you know, the case can be closed once and for all, okay?
Mm-hmm.
Now, first of all, going back to the day that the Air National Guard PR called me, by the way, you might find this interesting. Right after I got off the phone with her, I called my sister-in-law in Delaware, because it was her birthday. And mind you, they hadn't come out with the announcement yet till the following day in the paper. The first thing she says to me, oh, I just saw in the news that the lights that you saw in March were flares. They got the information before we did. Isn't that weird? Okay, so I mean, there's a lot of little red flags all over the place here. So tuck that away. At any rate, you know, on March 7th, 2000, mm-hmm. they tried to do a deployment. And people who are on the website, the Phoenix Lights Network, thephoenixlights.net, and go to the news page, there is a wonderful report by CNN that actually shows their deployment. And I have to tell you, Karen, it was a massive failure for them. It was a joke. They tried to make
like, it's so completely not like anything that anybody videotaped.
Oh, yeah. I mean, if you just look at the data, it speaks for itself.
Yeah.
I mean, they tried to make a triangle. It was upside down. It fell apart immediately. It was huge smoke trails, okay? Nothing. They could not do this. They could not do it. And that, I have to tell you, that really shot them in the foot. Anybody that saw that, and certainly anybody outside of Phoenix, had no clue that this had occurred. But anybody here, and let me tell you, everybody was ready with their cameras and with their eyes to see the so-called reenactment of the Phoenix Lights. And it was just a dismal failure for them. And really convinced the witnesses, including myself, that something else was going on here. Here they had their shot. They announced it big time that they were going to reenact the Phoenix Lights, and it was nothing like the Phoenix Lights, including the boomerang. Okay? That has never, to this day, 15 years later in March, the Phoenix Lights event and the videos around 10 o'clock have never been reenacted. Okay? That's really important to note. But at any rate, at that point, then this was 3 years later, that really hit me because then I realized, geez, you know, this is happening worldwide. Other countries, by the way, are much more open to these phenomena as being real and unearthly. Mm-hmm. And, you know, even Belgium is a model for what should happen. They got together during their sightings in the 90s, late 80s and 90s and early 90s, and got together with the university and the military and civilians to try to decipher what these things are. And I've always said, I mean, people say, so what were they? I don't know what they were. I don't know what they are, but I know that they are. And it's time we get this out in the open and we acknowledge that it's real. We accept that it's real, and we study it so we can move forward not only to find out who's behind these and who's driving these things, but also in our own evolution. And again, it is a choice. But at any rate, I continue to meticulously document everything. Ended up with a 750-page journal 4 years later. Had to go back to work to help put our younger son through medical school, who, by the way, is in the documentary. He's had a couple sightings with us, and he's a neurologist now. And I didn't know what to do with it. And I, as you mentioned earlier, worked at the Arizona Heart Institute as a chief clinical consultant of the Wellness and Imaging Center. While I pared down the book in my free time, the 750-page journal, to the best, most credible information that I found. And by the way, as an aside, not only about the UFO unexplained aerial phenomena, but while I was interviewing witnesses, a very interesting side road occurred that took me in a new direction, because a number of them had actually had near-death experiences as children that was reawakened by the Arizona mass sighting. And I find that very curious, because I did too. And I get into my near-death experience as a child, 8 years old, in detail in my book. But, and I will be describing it, by the way, in an upcoming presentation that I have at the Pennsylvania MUFON, Mutual UFO Network Annual Conference, in October 14th, we're showing the documentary, and October 16th, I'll be speaking there, and also at Barnes & Noble on Saturday. But I'm just starting to share that, and I do share it in detail in my book, because it was very fascinating about that whole thing and intriguing is that I thought, you know, could there possibly be, because people were affected so deeply by this sighting and in awe. And I have to mention, too, 15 years, Karen, there has not been one, to my knowledge, and I'm pretty intimately involved with this, not one report of harm, threat, or abduction associated with the Phoenix Lights. If anything, quite the contrary. People were in awe. People were excited. It changed people's lives. And that's what I found out when I started studying and looking for credible information concerning the connection between all unexplained phenomena. Lo and behold, again, I started finding amazing studies being done at university level, the Omega Project at University of Connecticut, Dr. Kenneth Ring, and also Dr. Raymond Fowler. People out there might know his name, and Dr. Bruce Grayson and Stuart Temblow were all finding a very intimate relationship, not only in the experience, whether it was near-death experience, out-of-body experience, unexplained aerial phenomena that have a mystical light associated with the experience. The experiences, and I lay it out very simply in the book, are very similar when you really look at the data. But what was,
really?
What was most poignant was the after effect, the positive awakening, the enlightenment that happened within an individual who truly experiences an unexplained phenomena experience.
Nope.
And I started calling them all. I'm sorry.
Well, I just wondered if we could talk a little bit about how these experiences are similar before we move on, because I've read a little bit about the near-death experience. I don't know very much about it. But it seemed to me that a few common elements were this feeling of moving down a tunnel and then a bright light at the end.
Right. Well, you feel like you're in another time and space. And
okay.
That's a really good question. I started calling all unexplained phenomena ups because they are so positive, and not only in real time. I mean, this is really interesting. When, and I'll get back to your question in a second, but in real time during the mass sighting, it was amazing because, you know, Independence Day movie had come out 6 months before. So a lot of the kids that saw this massive triangle formation of lights or craft coming towards them were scared. I mean, we are so inundated, and we talk about this in the fear, 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 and threat, 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 that as soon as we see something that's unusual and out of our realm of reality as we know it, right away we think that we get scared. And even Dr. Gary Schwartz says in the documentary, you know, if we're afraid of something and we see something that we're afraid of, how do you think we're going to react? And as I said, not one person reacted that way during the mass sighting. But at any rate, it's fascinating when you look at that data, and it speaks for itself. But we're asking about the similarities, and when you talk about being out of your body and maybe even going to a tunnel experience, there are very, and I see different cases in the book where people feel like they're coming out of their bodies, they're floating, they see beings of light, and so forth. I mean, there are characteristics that are very similar in all unexplained phenomena. But again, the most poignant thing to me was the after effect. And in real time, too, not only as the craft was coming towards these kids that were jumping up and down, Independence Day, a calmness took over them. A calmness took over adults as well. A connectedness to the phenomena that just change them forever. In fact, as the phenomena passed by them, they wanted to run after it and have their parents get in their car and run after it. So in real time, it transformed people in a positive way. And certainly afterwards, people's lives were changed forever. I mean, I have close to 20,000 emails, not only from here in Arizona, but worldwide of people. And most things can be explained, by the way. Most things can be explained, right? When somebody has an experience that's so unreal to them, an up experience, and truly acknowledges it, because some people deny it or blow it off, but when you truly let it sink in, it changes you forever. I mean, your whole worldview is changed forever. So
amazing. That's another
And I have to say, in long term, I mean, some of the people not only changed their eating habits to vegetarian, some went into the peace movement, others went into men. I mean, really, there is a message here. There is a message here, and you know, I'll leave you with this, because there is so much more to the story, and I hope people actually pick up the book, because what happened was that I squeezed the best of what I found, the most credible data, into 230 pages and came forward finally in March of 2004 with the first edition of the Phoenix Light, The Skeptic's Discovery That We Are Not Alone, and was so, I mean, it was pretty scary, Karen, to even think about coming forward, because, you know, certainly being in a wonderful position at the Arizona Heart Institute as chief clinical consultant, and just being a physician in and of itself, and how other people, and this could be a whole other hour, I mean, just, you know, are ridiculed and criticized and disgraced and discredited just for coming forward, that's got to stop. I mean, it's time we get this out in the open. And,
well, absolutely. And, you know, as you and I were discussing a bit during the break, I think it was over the break we said this, we were talking about how skeptics will say, oh, you believe in UFOs, well, how come it always... You know, the only people who see them are like one guy who's out by himself in the woods hunting. And, you know, you and I have to deal with this. Yeah, they do appear to more than one person at a time. They are do leave physical evidence. They do appear over large cities. You know, people will say to me, well, how come they never appear over a city? I'm like, is Manhattan big enough? Phoenix? Chicago? Mexico City? Los Angeles? How come you don't pick up a book? I want to say.
Exactly. And that's why I came forward ultimately, Karen. You just said it. Because there is so much misinformation out there, so much disinformation. When I came forward in 2004, by the way, the official and accepted explanation of the Phoenix Lights was that it was flares. And anyone outside of Phoenix or Arizona that didn't know the story kind of accepted it, okay? And can you imagine what that did to me? That was like, or anybody else that knew the story. It was like, how could I not come forward with this information? I did a lot of soul searching for years. I mean, I can't even tell you, because I don't need to do this. But for some reason, I need to do this. And if I can be a credible voice so people actually look at the data, then I've done my job. That's all I ask is to just look at the data. And once I came forward, I couldn't believe how many doctors came up to me and said, oh my goodness, you wouldn't believe, I saw this thing on the beach when I was 9 years old, and blah, 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 and they gave us their stories. It was so rewarding to know that not only did they feel comfortable, and by the way, any of your listeners out there that has not shared their story with someone for fear of ridicule, please email me. My email address is on the website, my contact, and, you know, even just telling one person, and that was really important to me, Karen, as a physician, to come forward for this very reason as well, is that it's very detrimental to your health to let those kinds of things fester, especially for years, and not get it off your chest. And once you do, it's very cathartic. It's very healing. So that was part of the reason that I came forward as well. But, you know, it was really important for me that people know the rest of the story if they care to look at it. And then I was approached by filmmakers, and I couldn't even think about it. I have to tell you, I was working 7 to 7 at the Heart Institute, doing radio programs like this into the night, and then Barnes & Noble and Borders book tours on the weekends. And I have to tell you, not only filmmaker who happened to graduate Brooks Institute of Photography, very persistent. His parents live here. His father's a doctor, who we know. And he said, I'm coming with my equipment, and we're getting started. And I said, wait a minute. I said, first of all, I don't have time, even though I'd love to do it. I mean, that's my passion, is to get something visual out there that I've been doing for the last 35 years. But I just don't have the time. And on the other side, I stayed anonymous for 7 years. how can I expect the professors at the university level, because it's precarious for them too, and witnesses that emailed me in confidence to share their stories. And I said, you know what, I'm going to give everybody a call that I think would work and let me see what happens. Well, every single one, except one who came on board later, enthusiastic yes. It was amazing. That was the first sign. That was my first sign, and they're incredible. Everyone, I mean, that's what's so important, to hear it from the people themselves. And we have a pilot, we have astronaut Dr. Edgar Mitchell, we have Frances Barwood, Councilwoman Vice Mayor Frances Barwood is featured. She's wonderful. Amazing witnesses and experts in the field that are just amazing, and we go through the whole analysis of why it could not be flares and so forth and so forth. But you know, on the other side, I got a call from some parents who had seen me at Barnes & Noble that arranged a presentation at a middle school, which I was amazed that they would do this topic, but they did. And cool. I come walking in there. This is what convinced me to do the documentary. And I come walking in there. It's the last period of the day. Over 200 middle school students, you could hear a pin drop. They thirst for this knowledge. There is nothing, and I'm sure your husband Richard Dolan could tell you this, there is nothing in our school history books about this topic. And that really hit me hard. I knew at that point, and by the way, I said to them, you know, does anybody believe that we are alone in the universe? Not one hand went up. And I said, does anybody believe that we are not alone in the universe? And every hand went up. And it really convinced me that I needed to do the documentary, and we started production. By June, it was so overwhelming, I had to make a choice. And you know what I chose to do? It was not easy giving up that position at the Arizona Heart Institute. I loved that job, and it was really an amazing experience. But I knew that I had to continue on this road, and it's been actually not only a labor of love, but it has evolved as more sightings and more witnesses come forward. 10 years later, after the mass sighting, suddenly the former governor of Farmington, who had mocked the sighting the day after the USA Today article came out, actually divulged, courageously or not, that he had actually seen a craft, the mile-wide craft, and it was not from here. It was otherworldly. And he is in the documentary as well. We have some of his statements. And, you know, that really opened it up, I have to say, to the next level. Because having a governmental official come forward and confirm that what happened here was extraordinary and not of our world is really taking a big step. So that really helped along, and the documentary's won over a dozen international film festival awards, which is amazing. I mean, we're so honored. Fantastic. It's not only for a documentary, but certainly one of the genre. And now, and I'd love to take, you know, questions or whatever after, but now I am entering the third phase. Now that the book, which by the way is in its third print, and I just came forward this past year with information of what has happened since I came forward in 2004, plus other information. I don't know if we'll have time to get into it today, but I have kept other data private for over a dozen years that I felt when I did this third edition that it's time that I divulge this data as well, because it might be important. I mean, now that quantum physics and quantum mechanics is postulating that there are many different dimensions out there and other times and spaces along with ours, why is it such a leap to think that there might be other intelligences in those other times and spaces? And I have data that can very well confirm that. So I am sharing it for the first time, data that actually was discovered by Dr. Bruce McAbee, the Navy optical physicist, renowned UFO investigator from Washington, D.C., if we have time to talk about that. But at any rate, now the third one, the book and the documentary have lives of their own. I'm getting back to my true love and passion, our kids and educating kids into the reality of things, and I'm now working on a curriculum for schools.
That is a pretty amazing project.
It is. It's an awesome project.
It sounds like a huge project, but this is actually going to go into mainstream schools? I mean, is that your plan?
Hopefully. You know, my AIDS, teen pregnancy, and substance abuse programs are being distributed as we speak for the last decade or more by Discovery Education now. And, I'm hoping that the door is open a little bit now for the possibility. And I know kids want it. And there certainly are teachers out there. I was approached by a senior math professor at ASU who actually handed me a crop circle of three orbs intersected by an equilateral triangle that blew me away. I have that in the book because that's exactly what my husband and I saw. And we're using that particular crop circle to introduce crop circles to the classroom. This is going to be an overview, comprehensive curriculum of the topic called Out of the Box, that will introduce kids from fifth grade through high school to the possibilities of unexplained phenomena and actually get into the most credible data that's out there, certainly, as introducing to crop circles and the mathematical components of real crop circles. It's mind-boggling. When the professor started looking at this one crop circle, he found so many equilateral triangles within that one crop circle. It was mind-boggling to him. He was blown away. I mean, there is some real data there that we haven't even started to delve into. And even to have them do artwork and make their own crop circles is very creative. The history part, there certainly is a vast history of credible data. And your hubby, Richard Dolan, I am just so honored and grateful that Richard is coming on board to help with that area and a timeline so that the kids, as well as teachers and parents, by the way, because I'd like to get them involved. I always try to get the parents and teachers involved in this, too. And again, there is nothing in the classroom, so certainly this will be welcomed, as well as creative writing. You know, what if we're not alone in the universe? How would that change our world if there are other intelligences out there? What would we tell them about us? And just get kids thinking. I mean, who's preparing the public for this? Really, who is preparing, especially the next generation, for what's ahead? So certainly this is very dear to my heart. And then we have conflict resolution. If we can't resolve early, how are we ever going to have a connection to other intelligences that might be very different from us? And as well as the science, certainly, behind all of this. And we now have a pilot program of fabulous scale. Kate Hooker, who is in a charter middle school here in Phoenix, is now starting. She actually came to me through Facebook last year, and I do have a page, Phoenix Lights Network, if anybody's interested, on Facebook. And she came to me and told me that she had her students reading the Phoenix Lights book in the classroom.
Oh, very
it was
cool.
Unbelievable to me. I mean, I'm just blown away. And the kids loved it. And we've been working together to really get something viable and exciting and creative into the classroom. And I'm working with some other teachers as well, the head of the one of the departments at the Tri-City School in Prescott. He showed the documentary to the school, and they loved it, and we're working with them. We're probably going to start a pilot program there shortly as well. So I'll keep you posted with what's happening, but this is something that's very dear to my heart. I'm very passionate about this, and I hope that, you know, we're trying to set it up in a way that it will be non-threatening, it will be information that's credible, that cannot be denied, and, you know, and let it go from there. So we're in the throes of developing it, getting feedback from the kids, and they're actually building half the class is, this one class is building a space station and the other half is building an underwater station, just to get them, you know, interested in the possibilities and in the words, the vocabulary and so forth and the science behind it. So, you know, and they're loving it. They're really excited about this. So,
As you know, as you and I were talking about in the first hour, there are several people listening now who were not with us for the first hour of the show, so it's just going to go over that briefly. We were talking about how this is really not accepted. You know, people don't feel like they can report these things, and, you know, so many people have had sightings, and where do you go? Who do you talk to? And they're afraid to say anything about it. And, you know, it struck me is a year or two ago, when ABC TV did a special on Stan Romanek and his story, and I know that's a very controversial case as well, and I'm not getting into that aspect of it, but I remember seeing it on the ABC TV website, and there were all these comments underneath, and there was a statement by a journalist who had been featured in this special, and I'm sorry, I can't remember the woman's name now, but I remember her comment. She said, it's actually, you know, no real doctor or scientist actually believes in UFOs. I thought, what? Again, you know, thinking. Lynn Kitai, MD, doctor. Stanford Friedman, nuclear physicist. Last time I looked, that was scientist. John Mack, you know, PhD, Harvard. Gosh, I mean, that's three right off the top of my head. And those are people I know.
Right.
And there are so many more out there.
Absolutely.
And, again,
and I learned that there's so many behind closed doors, by the way.
Exactly.
There are a lot of people behind closed doors. And you know, the bottom line is, and again, I have taken extreme lengths not only to have this explained to me and searching for a logical explanation and till today, and it's almost 17 years after my close sighting, there is none. It cannot be explained or denied. So what do you do with that? You have to move forward and start acknowledging that there are advanced technologies that are here, that are visiting us, whether it's interstellar, interdimensional, time travelers, spirit world, whatever. I have never said what they are because I don't know what they are. I just know that they are. And it really is time to just put it out there and let people learn, because that's the other side of this. And I know Richard has been working very strongly on disclosure and the changes that it you know could produce, because many people are not prepared. I mean, many people have either just, you know, are too busy with their lives, deny that it's even real, don't want it, you know, are fearful about it, and that's why education is the best protection. I've been saying that for years, and I believe that with this as well, and that's why I'm doing the curriculum, because, and the book and the documentary to help introduce the topic in a non-threatening, caring, gentle way, just as these phenomena, again, have been passing over people, touching people one person at a time. One person at a time. And when you look at the data, that's what it shows. And it's amazing how people transform. Once you don't have to have an UP experience, an unexplained phenomena experience, to have this positive transformation. All you need to do is open your heart and open your mind and learn about it. Looking at the data. Just as I did, because I found it took me a long time. I mean, it was 7 years of really, really soul searching and, you know, really pushing that reality as far away as I could for myself, but it kept getting closer and closer and closer. I saw these things. I mean, to this day, we don't have this technology on Earth. And if we do, again, I am very open. Show me. Show me. The military had their shot in March of 2000, and they blew it.
Yeah.
So, you know...
As you were saying, too, you know, early on when we were talking about some of the explanations for these things, and you said the official story was flares, you know, that all the lights in formation that people saw, that hundreds of people photographed moving horizontally.
Hundreds of people didn't photograph them.
Thousands of people saw them.
Thousands of people. We estimate over 10,000 people.
Wow.
And by the way, a new story that I have in my book, I mean, it wasn't just in Arizona. I had a commercial airline pilot contact me to tell me that their crew, with a commercial airline, there were 140 people okay, were passing from Phoenix to California. And I'm telling this for the first time in the new edition. And, you know, they're afraid to come forward because they were passing past Vegas about 11:30 that night on March 13th, 1997. And they saw this massive, mile to 2 mile wide object hovering over Vegas. And another, they called into the, whoever, the radar specialist to see if they were seeing it. And moments later, another commercial airline called in all frantic, what the hell is this thing in front of me? And suddenly another voice came on the radio and said, I want you to tell me exactly what you're seeing right now, like a very firm voice, and they freaked out. And they said, we don't see it anymore. And they, you know, they were just frightened to say anything.
Oh.
And about a half hour later, as they were approaching California, suddenly, like a half a mile away from their aircraft, and this is a commercial aircraft with passengers, they suddenly see this fireball, like a fireball, and realize that it's a flare. And moments later, on the other side, a military jet whooshes right by them with afterburners, freaking them out. I mean, in fact, the one pilot said that they jumped out of their chair.
So holy.
And they knew that somebody was trying to give them a message.
Uh-huh.
So there's a lot more to this story, and I tell all these little things in the book, but certainly there is so much to this story, and there's people that are afraid, like myself, to come forward. And but it's time. I mean, it's like enough. It's enough with this already. And what I've tried to do is to document the most credible data that cannot be denied, and let people decide for themselves. No, convince anybody of anything. I'm just sharing the data and let it speak for itself.
Yeah, just get the word out. Lynn, thank you so much for joining me this evening. I can't believe, I think we blew through the second hour even faster than the first, but it has just been absolutely fascinating hearing your personal account of this case that, like, everyone has heard of, and everyone's heard about it, but to hear you describe your actual involvement in the case is just another experience altogether. It was amazing. Thank you so much.
Thank you. Well, thank you, Erin. That's why these programs are so important, and I so appreciate you inviting me to share so that it does raise awareness. And if people just want to, if they don't want to read the book or look at the documentary, that's okay. Get on the website, Phoenix Lights Network, thephoenixlights.net, because it's filled with very fascinating, if nothing else, fascinating and informative information. So thank you so much for having me.
Great. And I hope we can visit again. We may have to. There's so much more.
Oh, there is, and the 15th anniversary is coming up in March, and
we'll
be sharing some new information there, too.
Well, let's plan on doing something in the spring, then. Fantastic.
Look forward to it. Looking forward to it. Thank you so much, and thank you to your listeners for listening. I really am honored to be able to share and impart this information, and hopefully they'll look further.
Great. Well, thanks again, Lynn, and thank you to all of our listeners. You've been listening to Through the Keyhole on the Paranormal Radio Network and also on UPRN 105.7 FM in New Orleans. Once again, I'm your host, Karen Doland. Thanks for joining us tonight in this live broadcast. Don't go away now. Coming up next is A Global Focus, coming up with Trish Sheridan. Thanks so much, everyone. I'll see you next week.
Keep looking up.